How's that? Can you hear me? Mic'd up? Okay, great. Okay, so I'm David. I build software, but I started in life as an epidemiologist. Anyone know what an epidemiologist is? One. Don't say dermatologist. Don't say skin doctor. I get that all the time. Epidemiologists look at epidemics, and they look at disease in populations, and they sort of come in after all the actions happened, and they try to figure out what happened, what caused what. So it's observational data. They're not collecting data in the moment, but they're observing data that's already happened. And this turns out to be exactly what healthcare needs right now, is a way to look at all that data that is generated in the process of getting care in the medical systems. So we endeavored to build software that enables epidemiology and outcomes research. It is software that physicians use directly. They can build patient groups. So there's a lot of software that helps doctors manage one patient at a time, the electronic medical record systems. But this software helps them look at groups and look at them over time and look for outcomes and look for causal variables and put those into predictive models and try to predict outcomes. And it's really not just a research tool. We actually want them to take action when they find a problem. They find a drug that's causing a bad reaction right there in the Bronx. They don't wait for medical literature to show that. They discover it locally. They take action. They get patients off of drugs that are doing them harm. And that's the intent of the software. This is being developed at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. And we have two other clients. Department of Defense is starting to use it in the Washington, D.C. area. And we're also working with an information exchange organization in the Bronx as well. So if you can imagine, what happens when an epidemiologist and a visionary physician get together and try to make software? They need a team, and they need to empower the team. So the first thing we did, posted, experts, please apply here. And we started building our team. This is about in 2001. Two of our managers are sitting here in the front row, Navneet and Mia. And I'm going to throw all the hard questions to them when they come up. But it also created an interesting experiment for us, because we had to be dev and we had to be operations. There was no one else to give our application to deploy or anything like that. So we had to learn from the beginning how to do both. And also, you know, team-centered leadership is in our bones, and that was required in this kind of context as well.
Thank you.
Claude. My name is Claude. I'm from, I do ALM, Application Lifecycle Management. So we've actually been working with Dave's team for a number of years now. And we're basically a consultancy. We're heavily focused, and I probably have a slide for that. All right, there you go. So what we do is help people take advantage of the Visual Studio platform, the tools of practice, agile adoption, testing, and so on and so forth. We also have a product, not there, which helps with release automation that complements the offering from a Microsoft perspective. Everybody hears me fine? All right, so that's good. When we started working together, we quickly realized that, again, the road that Dave's team had done, starting from really nowhere to actually starting building software and so on and so forth, there was a real passion on their end on ALM and trying to do better and trying to develop faster, better, more quality. So we realized when we engaged and that we had that as a passion. We also realized that throughout our engagements that both our spouses are actually chefs and have a big passion for food, and we have a passion for eating the food. It affects some of us more than the other, but that's that's another aspect. So when we started looking at it, we realized that they're actually more in common between food and cooking than anything else. First thing is, when you build software, you know, if you ship undercooked, that's not a good idea. Whether is it food, whether is it software? In both cases, it gets really buggy. Having a bad delivery is not a good thing either, and especially to your customers, if for sure they won't come back. It's also a bit of a team sport, and it's funny because the analogy when we started looking at it come from again, for me talking with my spouse who's a chef, a professional chef in a kitchen, and basically I was looking at how they do, and it's like, you know, the old meal experience that you go there, it's like a team. It's basically like a version that you go, and then every service, if it's a 5 or 7 service, they need to serve everybody together. So every plate, every dish is kind of a like delivering a PBI or functionality. And to get them, you get in the kitchen, you know, you have like people doing like the cold stuff and the cooking and whatnot. So for every plate, they need to come in together to deliver the right thing. So I was telling her, it's like very much like agile, like your meals are like sprints and so on and so forth. And she looked at me and she goes, what are you talking about? So we saw that comparison, and often we use a comparison when we discuss together between, you know, are we trying to fix the recipe or deliver the meal or whatnot. And when we looked at it, we looked at the evolution and the maturity level more as you start at the beginning, where what you do is you cook burgers, like minimum. You just sustain yourself to survive, or hot pockets or whatnot. So at the beginning, you just put out software, and when you start in there. And that's pretty much what we'll go through, kind of how Montefiore went to from the burger phase to being able to actually deliver 3-4 course dinner party, where you take care of the silverware and the presentation and all a series of other aspects, which in software it's no longer just throwing code out, but actually having code that works, that meets some quality condition, that's documented, upgradable, and so on and so forth, to how do you get to be deliver world-class software and have a world-class team to deliver software. So that's pretty much what we'll try to go through in terms of the presentation. The ingredients, like there might be a ton of different ingredients in cooking, but the ingredients for at building continuous delivery for your team and being able to deliver features regularly and whatnot, and have your diner's IP at the end of the day. The ones we'll focus about is really about the flow itself, is starting from requirements, going over to how you manage your code, how you manage your code, including how you deploy it, your database, your data, how you deploy into all your environments on your release pad. And basically, at the end of the day, how do you test those requirements? And often, we don't see requirements as an intrinsic part of a release flow. It is, because a big part of your release flow is actually testing against different stages with different goals, and you test against requirements. So having good requirements is a core ingredient of your release funnel, and then eventually getting into production. So what we'll do is I'll turn it over to David to go over all these steps. Thank you.
Okay, so starting in our burger phase. What was that like? As I said, it was a team of two. We had a physician sort of on above this, doing the fundraising and whatnot. But it was myself and a web developer. And he was coding the web pages, I was coding in the database and in the statistics world, and we CLG was born. Clinical Looking Glass was born just with that. We think about our environment practice, like the kitchen. This is where the meal is coming together, where we're producing software. And for us, that was one server under the desk. Okay, and we had two logical environments, so we had a little bit of separation of change. But it wasn't much, and there was also a statistics service running on the same server. The whole application could happen this way. Our build and deploy practice was copy the files to the other area, and that was about it. It's fast, it's easy, it's like a hot pocket, but it doesn't give you much. Our source control discipline, not there at all. We didn't have source control, we didn't have TFS. This was around 2002. But this is sort of tells you how the meal begins when you don't have source control. It's a mess. The requirements would come in long emails and long Word documents and about 10 features in one expression of requirement, and constantly changing. And it was really hard to get on top of that and to understand what to do. And This was our testing practice. The stakeholder was basically sort of going at the system in the way he wanted to, and you know, there was no sense of test case development or definition. We were really naive in our practices here. So the problem that we have, the release cycle is very, very long. And to get to a new upgrade, we were about a year and a half. Lots of things can happen in a year and a half. We can go from this to this. And we can go from this to this. Who's this guy on the other side?
That's a really tough year.
Okay, so it's the burger phase, you know. So moving on to the dinner party. This is when TFS was introduced and more team members are joining the team and we're recruiting, self-recruiting. So our environments are moving from a college-type kitchen to more of a chef's kitchen that can roll out a nice dinner party. So what does that mean? Our one server turned into six physical servers with separation for development. Actually, the development area was local to the workstation. A test demo for stability during a sprint for the product owner to show new features to end users and to the market. As we're going around showing what the tool can do, we wanted to demo from here. We also introduced, there was a, you know, years to get to this probably, but the upgrade environment was now another place where we could take the production, make a copy of it, and then try our upgrades there, and then go ahead into the client zone and try to get the upgrade to happen. But these were basically the purposes of these environments. We're using TFS at this point, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah, so started with MS Build. You get our binaries, moved on to TFS build to manage the configuration of each environment, the web config for each environment. But we had a problem. One of our clients, Department of Defense, was not accepting TFS doing a deployment. That is not cool for them, so we had to go to Wix pretty quickly. And Wix did another big step for us, which was it allowed us to install the prerequisites for each environment and to really manage all the change that's happening. We still had pretty extensive manual steps for the release manager to follow, but we were doing all of this with about 30 build definitions, initially sequencing them with C# code, but eventually able to do that automatically. And I think TFS 2010 allowed us to use the baked-in tools more. That allowed us to install for any client. Okay, the source control discipline, we tried to get a little more organized in our ingredients, you know, get our ingredients ready for making software a little better. And we started out, this is a common mistake that I think people make, especially if they're coming from lesser tools than TFS, is they're putting a node in the source control system for every component. So I don't know if you can see that, but we have our various components of the system all in their own code line. And that made it very hard to move it as a package. So we introduced the main line pattern, which you can see in TFS on the right here. And I don't know if I have a pointer here, but all of the source code is now subordinated under a folder called main, and main is allowed to branch and turn into code lines for other teams to work on. And this is great for scalability of team. So this allowed us to let other teams work in tandem. And while we couldn't necessarily hire more onto our team, we did have end of year money and we could outsource and we could engage external developers. And that was critical for doing that step. Okay, so what is the mainline pattern? Let's say that this first box is, you know, all that code that just got deployed. It just got released. Okay, we're starting a new sprint here. Our dev team takes a branch of that code and they begin work. But there's a problem in production, so we have to patch. And that change, we do a fix there, and we do a forward integration back to this dev branch to bring that new change into that branch, and they keep going and they're developing. And then we get some money and we want to hire another team. So this dev 2 team takes a branch off of the dev 1. They start work. Let's say that they need something. So this first arrow here, they're looking for a change from the core dev team internal, you know, the main team. They can send that to the branch, and they have that change. And then when they're done, you know, end of contract, they send their work back to the dev branch. And then that goes back to the main line for release. So we don't really do a lot of coding in the main line, even though it sounds like the one place to do it. We just do the integration back there, do the fixes there only. And then it starts over again. So that's basically the mainline pattern. So what does that enable? What did that get us? We were able to use a team of 12 and really expand and work with partners. So, you know, they're all working in different cadences. They're all following Scrum. You know, that was important to get the user story and that structure correct. But we were able to now move a little faster, deliver a bit more value. In Cycle here, I just want to point out, they're doing a lot of the test automation. So they're not developing core CLG functionality, but they're helping us with our operations programming, which is significant, as you can imagine. The requirements discipline in this stage was use case. And we had detailed, Mia was, you know, brought this practice to the team, very detailed use case steps. System does this, user does that, system does this, user does that, anti-use cases. You know, it was wild. And we would link those to functional requirements and non-functional requirements and business rules. And then we'd produce a big phone book specification that we'd go into peer review with. And our stakeholder, our physician, would fall asleep or jump out the window, one or the other. But he was not understanding what we're about to build. It was really not useful. But it was linkable. We were using doors at this time to capture the use case steps. We could then link test cases to that. I'll show you a little bit about that later. And you know, it's a step, but the peer review is the nightmare. And really communicating with our end user is impossible. Our test practice, this shows a little advanced practice with MTM managing the test cases, but we started with Word documents. You know, do this, log in, go to this module, enter these values, expect this result in a Word document, but that was hard because when you execute the test, you had to take a copy of it and sort of put notes and store it in the right place and make sure your name was on it and when you ran it and everything. Was kind of wild. But because we used the MHT files that were offered by TFS at the time, we were able to convert those easily into the MTM. So there was some tool on CodePlex, and we could set up the test cases. They were now work items, and they could be leveraged into test plans and then test executions, separate environment. And that was, you know, we took off a little bit more. So the mean time from release, down from a year and a half to 3 months, possibly, you know, give or take. We're not on a strict cadence for release, but we had about 4 releases a year. Now, moving into the world class zone, where we're, you know, and we're halfway there, I'd say. I'm not claiming that we're out there all the way. Let's start with the requirements. So we have a recipe. You know, this is the secret recipe that grandma gave to the owner of Artisanal in New York City. It's a cheese restaurant. It's cheese soup. It's very defined. It's sprintable. They can make this in an evening, and it can turn into a plate of food. And the equivalent for us is a user story. And user stories were a great thing. It was a great way to communicate with our physicians and our epidemiologists and users. And it also brought the team engagement up, right? The purpose, sort of, who is the user? What are they trying to accomplish? You know, what does the system have to do? But what's their business purpose or clinical purpose? while they're doing it. And that engagement was critical. We did a lot of persona characterization. I remember when Claude came in to coach the team on user stories, and he said, "What's your next feature? Say what it is." And I started talking. He's like, "That doesn't sound like a physician to me. You know, use the vocabulary of the persona and of the market segment, really." So we started to get a lot more alignment between what we're about to build and what those users want and how they can work with that. The user story, though, has a context. You know, there is more than just that to a user story. And I'm using Mia's trace matrix here. The user story has the conditions of acceptance. These are really a form of requirement for that user story. The test cases that test a user story link to it. The test runs link to the test cases. The bugs link up to the test cases. But they all trickle down from that user story. So what Claude said about you got to have requirements to build software and think of it as part of the whole set of ingredients that you're building with, that's what that means. We use DOORS. Okay, so what is DOORS and why did we want to use it? It's an important question for us, and we struggled with it as we converted into more agile mode. DOORS is an object-oriented requirement system. And it basically allows you to put your requirements together in any form, but they're very tractable, linkable. You can manage attributes about each requirement. We don't do any upfront design in DOORS unless it's really crazy feature that we're doing, lots of complexity in the analytic method, for example. The system is so complex that we can't afford to go back combing through work items and trying to find out what the rule was that we implemented. It was unacceptable. So what's inside of DOORS, I'm going to zoom this up a little bit so you can see the sort of thing and why it's so compelling. And if there are any epidemiologists in the room, you'll know exactly what that's expressing. This is a way to measure risk on a patient. It's called censorship of the observation period, so that you know you're basically looking for an outcome over a certain amount of time for each patient. They have a different time frame. We don't slice right through the patient life like a BI solution with a time hierarchy. We have to follow each patient in their own trajectory. So this rule expresses how censorship works in the system. Our client, Department of Defense, loves this sort of structure. They can understand it very easily. DOORS is sort of required for software that that they build. So we'd like to keep it. We also like the form of it. We don't want to enter requirements into a form like a work item. We like to flow, you know, like a document. You're saying one thing, you go to the next line, another thing, the next thing. You can notice the links on the side going out to other business rules. This is a business rule container inside of DOORS. We also have other things like functional requirements and non-functional global requirements. So this is a way for us to go back to and understand what the system does, what it should do. And it really helps us when things get hairy, and they get hairy. You know, the analytic methods are quite complex. So sometimes we have to start here, but usually we're in sprint, we're coming up, what do we want to do? Maybe I'm asking the PO, or maybe I'm going out to a stakeholder, but it always gets documented here in the end of the day so we can search it. Source control, we brought database into source control. That was a big step. And the application has about 8 different databases, hundreds of database objects, and they're now managed within those branches. And we can deploy from each branch. You know, the database in the dev area in particular, lots of updates are happening to that database. It has to be correct. Each night, we're dropping the database and rebuilding. So our CI practice has got a strong database component there to it. In the beginning, we used a C# scripter to organize the change scripts on the database so that if a developer needed a change to the database or a database, they could do it, but they had to script it and it had to get sequenced so that when we're deploying database, we can put down the basic database and then step through the change scripts to to get the database up to date. Now we're using SQL Packager to manage that workflow. Okay, so the environments here, this big step that we took is we virtualized. And virtualization allows us now to provision servers as needed. Department of Defense clients really needs us to be massive. They wanted us to be able to go enterprise. We're very regional right now. That's a lot of data. So we had to introduce performance environments and different kinds. And you know, how can we do scale out so that we're lashing servers together, distributing the jobs? That kind of scalability was much more possible once we had virtualized. We're also able to bring up client environments a lot more quickly when we virtualize. At our medical center, which you know their IT services group is pretty good, but it still takes a long time to get a server set up, acquired, set up, and burned in the data center. So virtualization helped us do that a lot more quickly. At this point, our build and deploy practice, we're using everything from before, but we're now introducing automation in the deployment process. And we're using InRelease as a product to do that. We haven't gotten all the way yet, but this month we're going to endeavor to go two or three more environments. We've got that first hop happening, and we're pretty encouraged by that. So anything to make that release process easier is good for us. We have, I don't know, I've heard some debates throughout the conference about what do you do during release time in your velocity tanks, you know, on the dev team. You know, we are very much a DevOps organization, so when we're releasing, our velocity very much goes down. And it's frustrating. Nobody likes it. It might be a bad Scrum smell, but we think it's the reality of Scrum when you're truly DevOps. There's no one else to do that work. So unless you're really automated and you have it all flowing flawlessly, you need to invest in that. So something to think about. But at this point, we're really building out that kitchen that can do anything and support as many teams as possible to do that. The test practice. So we're going to automation. And this has required us to really decompose the test cases into very granular pieces. It's really becoming another application. And you got to think of it that way. It takes a lot of attention. But basically, you need a test case that logs in and a test case that navigates this way. And then you're testing the functionality. But each test case, even though it's not really a feature or a user story, you have to decompose that way to have reusable objects. So the way we do that is in Sprint, we have manual test cases getting generated for new features. It goes on a backlog. And then we have InCycle coming right behind there trying to automate. So we don't take on that burden ourselves, and we pay other people to do it. Idea being that we focus on building the product and get other people to help us with the ops side where possible. So we have about 70% of test cases automated on that backlog. It's a moving target, so that number's not always constantly changing. And then we got to get those tests to fire in every environment. That's not so easy also. We bolt on. We're a BI application, so the database is whatever the client has. It's their clinical data repository. It can be any structure. So we have a data adapter layer that maps on to these structures. Basic fact and dimension organization is all we need. But it makes testing really hard because you don't know. You have to test those mappings, and each client is going to have a different mapping structure. So you can't always expect certain kind of clinical data to be there to test. So it's pretty challenging. We're using coded UI tests to do this. And obviously the good benefit here is executing the tests is a lot faster. The problem is the UI tests are breaking when they make any change to the UI. And you know, our approach is test the UI and then go right below it and start testing there so that we don't break as much. But the other big step we had to do was all that work that InCycle does, we have to own it. And then when we check in code and a test is breaking and it's not your code, you better fix that test. No broken tests, no failing tests, unless it really means failing code. So that's a cultural issue there, but we're getting through that. So the idea here is test early, test often. This is kind of like I'd say it's a dev smoke test. You know, it's the chefs testing the food instead of the patron. So that's the idea there. So in each of these ingredients, we're putting in a lot of effort to do them all and to do them well. And we can focus on each one in different times, from the requirement to the coding practices. You know, I'm not touching on a lot of stuff here like code analysis and some of the other things we might be doing in that code box, the unit tests. The build and deploy work, it's a lot. And you have to be prepared that your velocity is going down. I believe that when you ask the same developers to work in these other areas. The way I sort of confirmed that for myself, it was a suspicion, but I'm in an organization where we have to do timesheets. We have to chart the time against specific tasks. And we don't go too granular. We don't manage the work in a project work plan like that. We're agile. But we can capture actuals. We have to. So I pulled that data. And I categorized all the tasks for 3 years of work there into disciplines, development environments, and deployment. And you can see here that our development work is actually, the percent of time spent there is going down. But the percent of time spent in that virtual world of the environments and the deployment practices, you know, getting in release working and getting our Wix installer working and maintained and all of that, that's going up as well. So this is the trade-off. This is the DevOps reality when you really are in that kind of organization. But it gets you to this goal. We're not at this goal, but we endeavor to be here. And what do you guys think? Like 3 months, 4 months, we're going to be there? And that is when it gets really exciting, because the traction with the users is very strong, and we can really nail their needs before they change. That's really happens to us. I would also say between those external development teams that are now enabled and under our architectural supervision and working with our tooling and everything else, I'm giving an order of magnitude increase in velocity around twofold, with an increase in value around threefold, mostly because we can get the feedback more quickly. It's not just we're cranking stuff out the door, but the value is a whole experience with the development team. So we're trying to really exploit that. We've started user groups and whatnot to interact with us more. And finally, the business scalability, getting the application up and running. This is not something, you know, if you're in the healthcare IT world, you'll know these systems are massive. And getting a client up and running is a big deal. You don't just sort of download from the internet and you're using an application like this. But just setting a client up and getting them ready to go, we've probably dropped from 6 months to 1 month. Okay, so takeaways.
Maybe, yep. Anybody ask a question on all this so far? Comments or whatnot?
Before we continue. Right, time that's achieved, that slide you had up last. You say about 2 times increase in delivered functionality, but you see a decrease in your development time. What do you attribute the increase in delivered functionality to?
The development time that I showed you was the internal team. It did not account for the external work that goes on.
Okay.
So I'm combining that external work.
Okay. One other question. You had you said you're somewhere around 70% automated test, give or take, just kind of as you're checking code, that's going to kind of change. Do you think you can get much higher with that number and still meet your definition of done within your sprint? Or do you feel like that's kind of the limit that you're...
We don't require automation as definition of done. We don't believe that we can get all that done in the short cadence. and we're outsourcing. So we definitely have to have manual test cases defined and executed and passing, but those go on to the backlog. So, you know, can you ever get to 100%? No, because the denominator keeps growing on you all the time. And some you're moving out, you have to keep it fresh. The test suite, you don't want, you know, tests to run that don't matter anymore. So it, you know, you just want it to be right behind in our world. I know others do that differently.
It's been handed down to us that we need to be about 90 to 95%
at end of sprint.
At end of sprint.
And wow.
It's just a struggle to get there. So
yeah.
I
can feel your pain.
Are you talking unit test or automated test? Both.
Both.
Okay. So you have to go TDD then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, we're 95% unit test and 90 to 95 on automated test, to be it coded UI or however they want to do it. So.
Okay. Yeah.
You've outsourced some of your initial test development. Have you? It seemed like your developers are covering your deployment automation work. That's the division you have.
Yes.
Have you thought about or previously tried to set that into a specialized? I'm kind of wondering what the. I am a release manager. I basically live in that 15%.
Uh-huh.
And often I come into groups that I wonder what your experience is where the developers.
I left out a detail. We did engage a single consultant from Wintellect, John Robbins. You might know him. He really set our Wix architecture in motion, but now we've taken it into the team and we maintain it. Anything else to say there?
How does the developers deal culturally with that? Do they see it as their job, or is it something they own, or do they feel like they own, or is it something they feel like?
Why don't you answer that, Navneet? How would you say the team feels about the Wix?
Right. So Wix was introduced for deployment. Right? Initially, we were using plain simple MSI for the web deployment. And the developers were owning that. You know, they were the ones who were creating those MSIs. Problem was that once those MSIs are deployed, they are the ones who are also supporting the release manager all the time. So we wanted a solution where something can be done for this. What I like to call it as like no-word document deployment, which means that you give MSI to the release manager and you just walk away.
Yeah.
So we've engaged John Robbins, and John Robbins, as we all know, I think it's a big name in the technical community, and he does a lot of work in debugging and things like that. He told us that, you know, let me do this Wix solution for you with your team members. So he engaged our developers. They combined, write this Wix packager. And it was then given to the release manager for deployment. Mm-hmm. So now the Wix package is under our jurisdiction, and we maintain and enhance it.
Okay.
So we have recently released a new API for our in our suite, and one of our developers in the team extended that Wix package. So the way to do that is to get an expert advice initially, and then bring it in your team. That's our belief, you know, that's our cultural belief that everything must be done. Our developers are a first-class citizen. With the help of great, you know, consulting companies such as InCycle and Microsoft and Wintellect.
The big advantage of getting the team to own the deployment is that it's not only that they'll fix it and whatnot, and they won't throw problems across a barrier to the other team. It's more that also when they think about the next thing, when they make choices in which technology to use, how they package it, how they structure the components to start with, they create ops-friendly software to start with.
Deployable, yeah.
Yeah, and over time then, they remove the problem they just by not creating part of the problem to start with. So for sure, it's a great way to do it, and there's a lot of value in trying to bring in to the dev team responsibility for how it deploys. The other thing also in this approach is that if you deploy in your first environment using the Wix and the same technology, then you fix it as you go. So it's no longer we develop for the sprint or the 3 months in previous cases. And then at the end, now we have a week, 2 weeks to set all that. Now it's just the actual deployment of, how do I package and deploy my code is as important as my database, my C# code, and whatnot. It's basically a not considered part of your package or of your first-level, first-class citizen in terms of coding. And that DevOps attitude helps a lot in terms of then being able to deploy a lot easier. So that's what we observe here, but also in many other cases.
And I agree the advantages are huge. I'm more interested in the cultural adoption because it hit places where it's like, well, that's not my job. So they made it and it's resented.
Yeah.
But the ownership of that, of feeling like it's a first class citizen, yeah. was there any barriers, or did the developers just jump into taking on that?
I think they're so used to it on our team that they feel, you know, if anyone does any development, they better give it over. You know, it's ours, and we should have done it in the first place, and why are you outsourcing anything? You know, that's more of the jump we had to make, that, you know, you're going to be the core, you're doing the engine work, and you're doing the really fun stuff, but you're also doing that harder, maybe not so creative work, but that... I don't think we had a big barrier.
They were part of design. Yeah. That's a big thing.
Another very important thing. In all of our external development, we engage the team to help design and set the architectural direction. Certainly, we do the requirements side of it, but the team also has a lot to say. And then when the time comes to integrate the solution, they have to come up to speed, understand the whole thing, and no matter what it is, if it's core functionality or Wix installer or what have you, automated tests.
The other thing I'd say from in my case, looking at multiple organizations, is our agile team, it's a lot easier to make those changes over time because one of the core value is you deliver workable software, so you have a definition of done, you have like mechanism where basically, you're looking at delivering iota of running value, and running value means on the customer and environment. So if you're more waterfall and you're structured along, you know, a practices, it's a lot more difficult from a change. So it becomes almost the same question as you know, making a change to agile. But for agile team, it's not a big thing. There's learning to be done. So again, here that you know, expertise was brought in, learning was supported, and it came over time, right? First few people, and then more people. So I think those are kind of good practice to bring in. But at the end of the day, now you build software that you can deliver every night. You repackage the way you'll do at the end of the month when you go to prod. So I think that's interesting in that sense.
What barriers are you facing getting from the quarterly to monthly release cycles currently?
It's really the efforts, the task switching. You know, until we're automated, we're not going to make it. So in release, better work. You know, that's how we're thinking about it is if we can let the systems, the deployers do all the work, sort of, you know, transfer all of that knowledge that we have into those deployers, have it be automated. We're hoping that can move. But right now, it's like the tape backup that doesn't finish in 24 hours and starts again. That's what we would be doing. We have so much effort in the release that, you know, there would be no dev to release in a month later. So that's really the linchpin, is the automation.
I have a topic. I mean, the off-topic, so if it is, just let me know. I'll talk to you later. It's about the defense contractor component of your business. Did they require doors?
No. It's tribalism. You know, they feel better about us when we're showing them doors requirements.
And was there a CMMI component to your contract?
No.
And what was the question?
Was there a CMMI component? So did we have to certify at a certain level? No. There was a lot of security testing. You know, they put us through the ringer. But
it's not a it's a grant. It's grant supported. Congressional grants initially, and some Army or joint grants. So it's actually not a contract. There is a contract, but it's for grant dollars. So it's not quite as stringent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any like FDA regulation and formal validation protocols for releases? My client's in healthcare and more on the product.
We don't. There are meaningful use requirements on reporting systems. but it's not at all at that medical legal level that the electronic medical record systems have to go through. They're probably missing it, because this system is producing actionable work lists. You know, they can change patient lives, hopefully save them, but you know, they probably should be adding that. It makes QA really important.
So let's edit this part out of the thing.
Yeah. Oh, 1 second.
So come back to the ATPs, that your automatic tests, unit tests, or UI tests that are not part of your definition of done. So you have to do them at the ground. What we found is when we were doing this, developer had a tendency to create something which is not testable. So
I didn't say unit tests. Just automated tests that started as manual tests.
But even the UI tests, you have to do something special to make them testable. Otherwise, you try to automate
yes.
them using the UI and not as it works. So how do you manage it?
Yes, there was, what was the move we had to do for all of the Silverlight screens to make them testable?
I had to decorate the code.
So yeah, there's sensibility, but we get that communicated back from the developers of the automated test. Hey, we need this from you, and then it gets done by the team, and they get branched, you know, forward integrated to their branch. Okay. Any other quick? Yep.
Just one other thing. So when you talked about the DORS requirements, and you had that on the left, and then you had user stories to the right. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The world of DORS requirement, that what they a lot of people call a heavy requirement model, agile teams say, stop, don't do that anymore. And while we embraced that, we knew that specification wasn't working, the way we were articulating new features was not working. So we wanted to make a change, but we were not willing. And Mia was a big, strong advocate. She talks a lot at the DORS conferences, so you know, get her later. To maintain that requirement model, because of the complexity of this system, we really wanted to have left behind a full description of what the system does and how it does each step of analysis. There are raging debates in epidemiology about what's an appropriate statistical model to use. We have to produce that very quickly. If we're in those debates, and that's really what it was for.
But just to be clear, the Scrum team on a day-to-day basis, their requirements are captured in work items and TFS as user stories. Right. So that's what they're working with. It's just
the new,
when you're looking
new
at the new feature, and then DORS is basically on their way out, having all that complexity of what the system is. It gives you kind of a big wiki or description of the system.
So do you like have to say that every DORS requirement has a user story?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It starts with user story. All of it starts with user story. And it might be an epic, you know, a higher level, but we put in the placeholder and then we start linking. You know, if the feature is very complex and we have to reconcile it with existing rules of analysis, for example, we might start in DORS and blow out some requirements that aren't yet built, but we'll tag them as not built and targeted for release X. But typically, we don't. You know, typically, it starts as a user story, full blown, and then as we're in the sprint, hey, that's a new business rule, pop it into DORS, done.
Correct me if I'm wrong, you started with DORS and then did user
stories? Yes.
So that initial iteration, did you go and create user stories by your existing DORS requirement?
No.
Did you do that every time?
No, that would be considered logically pure, but impractical.
So now how close are you? Just out of curiosity, how close are you?
There are large parts of the application that we don't have user stories for because it's pre-user story development. There, however, are requirements in DORS that describe those parts of the system. Key point about the DORS requirements model is it's functionally organized. User stories, as you know, are iteration organized.
Yes.
You have to remember what sprint you did the work in to go look at the user story and look at the conditions of acceptance and see what might have been decided. Instead, you go to DORS and find the functional area And you can look in the requirements there and see, ah, okay, this is the rule, but when did we code that? And you can follow the traceability over in DOORS to find out what release it was in or what sprint it was done in.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Is there any integration between DOORS and TFS, or is this all done manually?
There is integration. We're not using it.
They claimed it.
There is integration, but we keep being a step ahead of them in TFS. So just about the time they were releasing the 09 integration between DOORS and Microsoft, we went to 10. And then we went, you know, so we beta tested the earliest implementation.
So you're basically doing a right-click copy work item link and pasting that in.
Yeah, and it's not onerous because, you know, we're in a given, we do it as we do each sprint. It's not a lot of user stories. We also do bug fixes during sprints, and those do not, you know, get that linking. So it's, there are two of us who do most of that work. It's not onerous.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just hit some takeaway points. The environments, aim for those performance and demo environments if you can, instead of just dev, QA, staging, prod. If you can introduce a demo area or an upgrade area, that helped us a lot stabilize a release before going to the client world where it needs to work. Go virtual, that was a big thing for us, or go cloud, which we have not done, but there's a lot of speakers that make a compelling case there. In source control, get into mainline immediately. You know, get some config management books and understand mainline or hire Claude. He'll tell you all about it. Practice the branch merge. You know, just if you haven't done it yet, just try it. You know, here's a little change. I'm going to do it. I'm going to merge back to you. And just get people used to it. You know, get them feeling it. At the beginning, we were scared to death of branch merge. Now we do it regularly, and we manage it ourselves. We don't have a build manager who does that alone. Include the database. That was especially if you're a BI app. It makes things a lot easier. In build and deploy, use the same solution in all the branches and all environments. So there was a time where we were doing TFS build to get out of dev into QA, but then we were going to the client with Wix, and you know, the Wix package had defects, and why isn't it failing over here? Well, it was a different solution, so we had to really bring that together. Use Wix early. I guess all of these recommendations kind of depend on your context, but for us, that was important, and auto-deploy also a great thing to do. Requirements, go with user stories if you're not. Protest and advocate if someone's stopping you from doing that. It makes a big difference. Stakeholders will love it. Decompose into short iterations. So, you know, those big unwieldy narratives have to be sprintable. And there's techniques to make a user story very clean and tight and doable inside of a sprint. Refinement or grooming, I'm sure you've seen sessions about that. Which we do with the team as well. And keep a requirement model somehow if it applies. If you're in a world where you're in and out, you're doing quick jobs in and out, you probably don't need a requirement model. You can probably leave it all as conditions of acceptance in the user story. But for a complex application that is going to develop over years the way ours has, this was a big step. And finally, in the test discipline, use MTM to articulate your test cases. Even if it's all manual and someone's just clicking away, MTM's going to really be awesome to record when something was done, how many steps passed, where it failed. It does a lot of recording of the environment as the tester is going through. It really helps with the repro problem because they're capturing so much in a test execution. It helps the developers understand what's happening. And then when you automate, definitely automate if you can. Try to get below that UI layer, but don't leave it behind. Obviously, you have to test the UI, but then underneath that, where you're testing the logic of engines or different services, go for that. Maybe it's integration testing. So that's what I'd say on the take-homes.
Yeah, one other thing in the experience and is that if you look at it from a tooling perspective, a lot of things comes with TFS and what's in the bucket. And the goal is not to to say, you know, TFS is the only answer. But one of the things that's important in this story is that all these came out. The other aspect that they were using in release or those doors with semi-integrated or integrated a little late. But the key is to go with a set of tools that's already done. The difference it makes is that for you to put velocity on your release flow, you're working on your builds, you're working on your deployment, you're working on bringing your database change in and so on and so forth, as opposed to go and buy a bunch of specific tools and then spend a lot of time in integrating, which we live with other customers, where a lot of effort is not on actually, you know, if you want to click, doing the cooking itself, but really working on your cooking tools and working on your kitchen and whatnot. So that's one of the good things with the platform we have with Visual Studio. It gives us a lot of things. So now it becomes more about how to learn to do it and how to do it with our own things. So from a broad perspective, to increase velocity for your overall release path, you know, the idea of using integrated tools is really a good idea. So if you look at it, maybe if we step back from the going from one end to the other, and again, I won't go over all of these, but if you look at the main steps on all cases, it's really starting with we do what we think based on what's there to get more into a state where we know what we're doing, it's deliberate, it's manual, we do it well manual, and then you start automating all of these ingredients one after the other. So and at the end of the day, to be able to deliver very quickly, to deliver continuously, either at the end of every sprint or even shorter, you need basically to hit all your aspect one after the other and do it by step. And the key here is really it's a step-by-step process. There's no silver bullet. So don't expect to go in and say, I'll buy the tools. And, you know, some of the questions I think showed that there's the people side of things, there's a process side. But the key is to be deliberate about it, to kind of go in, basically put it, you know, week after week, month after month, and over time, continuous delivery really is the result of a good ALM practice and a good series of practice. And at the end, you'll need to be able to automate. You cannot automate what you don't do well or don't understand or don't control, at least from an intellectual and structural perspective. So get it right, and then you can start automating a lot. David?
I think that's it.
Any other questions?
We have about
answers
a minute
on all of this.
How often are you doing your reverse integration after with the two team split to get back?
As needed.
Okay.
As needed. So, do you mean reverse integration? That would be as the release comes up. So it's sort of timing with release goal.
From dev 2 up to dev 1.
From dev 2 to dev 1.
Yes.
Also, as needed, until the release is happening and we're starting to integrate everything to get out to release. But really, that we're communicating with that external team to ask, you know, when that's necessary.
So that's still not complete CI, that you have an external team that's detached until kind of post or leave?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
I'm glad you did this after lunch.
Why?
Everyone.